From Ground Zero Radio, this is Democracy Now in Exile. Is the U.S. prepared for bioterrorism? Gas mask sales are soaring. The General Accounting Office warns the federal capacity to respond to a bioterrorist attack is fragmented and underfunded. And the Centers for Disease Control in Atlanta is under a gag order. President Bush's Anti-Terrorism Act passed the House last night. We'll talk to electronic surveillance experts about how the so-called Patriot Act threatens civil liberties and privacy. And the families of undocumented immigrant workers who are missing from the World Trade Center towers are afraid to come forward. All that and more coming up. Welcome to the War and Peace Report, broadcasting just blocks from Ground Zero. I'm Amy Goodman. Secretary of State Colin Powell said yesterday a prospective military strike in Afghanistan against the al-Qaeda network would be only the first step in the U.S. campaign against terrorism. At the same time, the Bush administration said it's preparing to substantially boost its humanitarian aid to Afghanistan. Bush was preparing to announce expanded humanitarian aid to Afghanistan in a visit to the State Department today. The new money will approach $100 million. Over the weekend, Bush dipped into an emergency fund and authorized an additional $25 million in relief aid to Afghan refugees. This brought U.S. assistance to more than $205 million. The prospects of U.S. bombing has accelerated a grave humanitarian crisis of Afghanistan, with hundreds of thousands of people fleeing their homes and more than a million facing possible starvation in the near future. An envoy of Afghanistan's ruling Taliban said in remarks published today that the movement would not hand over Osama bin Laden, even if there was evidence to implicate him in last month's attacks on the United States. The remarks were made by Taliban's ambassador to Pakistan, Mullah Abdul Salam Zaif, to the United Arab Emirates Al-Khalij newspaper. The representative said, "We will not give Osama bin Laden to the United States, even if we're presented with evidence implicating him in the September 11th attacks." He went on to say, "And if we get from them, the United States, such evidence, we will check it thoroughly, and then we will conduct a trial in a Sharia court. If this court convicts him, then we will see then what we will do." The comments could not be immediately verified, but if true, were the first indication by Afghanistan's rulers that they would not hand over bin Laden under any circumstances, though they said that they would try them themselves. Most House Democrats have tended to oppose trade promotion authority. This news from the New York Times. House lawmakers announced a compromise agreement that would give President Bush the authority to negotiate trade accords with limited congressional involvement, a tool the Bush administration says will help it recruit allies in the fight against terrorism. House Republicans said an agreement with several moderate Democrats allowed them to schedule a committee vote on expanded trade negotiating powers, known as trade promotion authority, on Friday, with a full House vote coming as soon as next week. Most House Democrats have tended to oppose trade promotion authority, once known as Fast Track. They argue that it unduly restricts congressional prerogatives to make sure that trade agreements do not undermine U.S. interests by impinging on its sovereign laws or subjecting U.S. workers to unfair competition from abroad. Enhanced trade powers were last approved by Congress in 1988, setting the stage for NAFTA. President Clinton's attempts to revive this authority failed repeatedly. Since the terror attacks in the United States September 11th, several governments in Central Europe have called for tighter security precautions, possibly reversing the direction of democratic gains the nations have made. One critic of the trend is Amnesty International. In a report being put out today in London, the rights group warns, in the name of fighting international terrorism, governments have rushed to introduce new measures that threaten the human rights of their own citizens, immigrants, and refugees. It cited a wave of attacks on Muslims and other foreigners in the United States, Europe, and Australia, and efforts by governments from Hungary to China to increase the powers of the police and security officials. In the Czech Republic, for example, the lower house of parliament rushed to approve a bill easing the access of the police and intelligence services to private records, including telephone records, without judicial oversight. Another proposal would limit certain rights of asylum seekers. In Hungary, authorities confined in a single camp at least 812 Afghans still in refugee camps, an action that rights groups say is a direct violation of international conventions. And this news from Chicago, a federal appeals court upheld a jury's finding that abortion opponents violated racketeering laws with their violent demonstrations outside clinics, rejecting arguments that the protesters were merely exercising freedom of speech. In a 3-0 ruling, the 7th U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals said the demonstrators had gone beyond free speech when they trespassed on clinic property and blocked access to clinics with their bodies, including at times chaining themselves in the doorways of clinics or to operating tables. The National Organization for Women and Abortion Clinics in Milwaukee and Wilmington, Delaware, had sued anti-abortion groups under federal racketeering law to combat what they described as violent tactics. The women's group Paprika here in our Firehouse studios, just blocks from Ground Zero. I'm Amy Goodman. Lori Garrett writes in Newsday, with public anxiety about bioterrorism on the rise, gas mask sales soaring, and talk shows rife with alarming claims, the head of the Federal Department of Health and Human Services, Tommy Thompson, said America's prepared to deal with any kind of biological attack. But public health experts throughout the nation say his comments made on the CBS show 60 Minutes do not reflect a two-week-long gag order that's kept them from getting specific information about preparedness from such agencies as the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention in Atlanta, leading to confusion and concern. Though there's no public evidence that any bioterrorism agents have been or will be used in the New York region, officials prepared for the worst-case scenario yesterday, reviewing security and, in some cases, tightening it. The General Accounting Office warns that the federal capacity to respond to a bioterrorism attack is fragmented and underfunded. The GAO report describes a government that lacks a clear line of authority over the planning process. At least 7 executive branch departments have bioterrorism programs, and an estimated $156 million was spent on bioterrorism programs in the year 2001. The report says the fragmentation among these programs is so extensive that no two departments even share a common list of the pathogens most likely to be used as biological weapons. Lori Garrett is a Newsday reporter and author of Betrayal of Trust, The Collapse of Global Public Health. She joins us on the phone. Welcome to the War and Peace Report, Lori.
Hi, good morning.
It's good to have you with us. Can you lay out what you think is the threat and what you think is unsubstantiated hype?
Oh, goodness, I wish I could in a nice, neat little box put those two things out for you, Amy. The problem, of course, is that the federal government is speaking with many voices at once, and there's a lack of clarity. Tommy Thompson, the Secretary of Health and Human Services, was on the Hill yesterday speaking before the House, the Senate Appropriations Committee, and repeatedly said, you know, we've taken care of everything. There's nothing to worry about. We're prepared to handle any threat. Everybody should calm down. And senators from both sides of the aisle said, we don't believe you. You guys do not have the situation under control, and we are really upset about it. Part of the reason for the confusion is Attorney General Ashcroft has repeatedly told us in one setting after another that another shoe is yet to drop from the alleged terrorists, and that one shoe that they're quite certain is amongst those ready to drop is a bioterrorist shoe. We heard Secretary Rumsfeld, the Secretary of Defense, saying much the same, and Andrew Card, who's the Chief of Staff in the White House, has gone even further, publicly saying that there is strong evidence that bioterrorist attack is in the planning. So the messages from government are mixed. They certainly have done a lot to contribute to the fear. And then, of course, the whole issue of crop dusters and the giant 18-wheeler dangerous explosive tanker issue contributed to the sense that something is afoot, something is being planned. What in reality, we know is very little. There are quite a lot of things in intelligence circles and in scientific circles that lend credence to the notion that we will see some sort of attempt to use biological weapons sometime. But whether it's in this time frame, whether it's specifically related in any way to what happened to the World Trade Center, is almost impossible to say with any certitude right now.
We're talking to Lori Garrett, who has been writing extensively about the issue of bioterrorism. At this point, with the situation as it is, have you looked at what is down at the World Trade Center, just in general health issues, with the kind of incredible, you know, catastrophe that has taken place there?
Yes, of course. I've been down there quite a bit. I don't think that there's anything there that poses a significant health hazard in terms of biologicals. Very horribly, the bodies were cremated, and we're not really recovering much in the way of bodies. Those few bodies that have been recovered have been amongst the rescue workers who were not inside the building but in the periphery area and were killed by falling debris and so on. Inside, all the rescuers are finding is body parts and worse yet. So as far as the potential that has often been forwarded, that we're going to have disease from carcasses and so on, There is no evidence for that right now, and it's very, very tragically and sadly what we actually have is something, a funeral pyre. Now, as far as the gas smells and terrible odor that has been rising from Ground Zero, and if you're nearby, you certainly notice it every time the wind blows your way, the health department has repeatedly told us there's nothing in that effluent that is a hazard to human health. But it has been changing within the last few days. And clearly there's now a kind of metallic taste in your mouth when you inhale it. There's some sense that something doesn't seem right. I think that what we're getting down to is lots of burning computers, lots of plastics and metals that are giving off gas. And I think the health department is probably right in that unless you're right down there inhaling it all day long, it's probably not a health hazard to the people of New York at this time.
And then the issue of asbestos that was used in the building, fiberglass that can be as carcinogenic.
Well, the asbestos content appears to have been quite low. The asbestos sensors so far have not picked up any significant readings, so there's some comfort in that. Fiberglass, again, if we were looking at the level of, I mean, the estimate is that in the sections, the floors closest to the actual plane attacks, the temperature was well over 2,700 degrees Fahrenheit. Well, that'll take out everything. I mean, fiberglass is not going to survive that either, not in a form that can be inhaled. So I think right now there are many, many things that New Yorkers need to be worried about that are quite valid, and there are many that we don't need to be worried about, but that one can get very exercised about. And I think it's important for New Yorkers to try and focus on the right things. And I'm very concerned about the level of panic in the city, the sort of jitteriness, the sense that we are a fragile population right now, lots of nerves on end, and any new event could really shatter a lot of people. I think it's worrisome, for example, that we're now at the beginning of the flu season, and we do not have a vaccine this year. We are hearing now from the CDC and from the pharmaceutical companies that there are some problems, once again, as occurred in the last 2 years in a row, in developing vaccine on a timely basis. And we may not have vaccine available until well into November, which means well in deep into the flu season. And my concern is that we're going to see a lot of people in this atmosphere of fear getting the flu and going to ERs saying, I think I have anthrax, I think I have, you know, whatever biological agent. I think we have that level of agitation right now, and it's very, very important to try and calm everybody down.
One last comment, Lori Garrett, on the gag order around the issue of bioterrorism that seems to be preventing the different government agencies from dealing with each other and the CDC?
Yeah, this is very significant. And I must say, I'm pretty appalled by it. What happened when the moment that there was the assault on the Pentagon, that kicked in a series of government orders from the White House that amongst the things in this sort of cascade of orders was a gag order on the entire Department of Health and Human Services, which includes the CDC and the NIH, the National Institutes of Health. This effectively meant that no one could get answers to any questions, whether you were media, general public, or for that matter, the head of health for some department in Des Moines, Iowa. And one of the things that was very worrying was probably as a matter of routine, but we still don't know for sure because they're under gag order and they cannot answer the question, the CDC was evacuated on September 11th, and the director of the CDC was hustled off to a private airport placed on military transport. Of course, the CDC houses 120 different strains of smallpox, Ebola virus, and countless other, you know, very, very worrisome, dangerous viruses, because that is the center of our high security laboratory. So this was cause for concern. As I say, it probably was simply a routine thing, but since no one's allowed to answer our questions, we don't know. The effect nationwide of this gag order is that I'm hearing from doctors all over the country that when their patients are freaked out, there's no one that can answer the phone and tell them, you know, what does anthrax do, what does plague do, et cetera. They cannot get answers to very specific questions in city after city around the country about how best to organize and prepare their health systems and their medical infrastructure in the eventuality of a bioterrorist attack. And so the irony is, you know, the White House has issued this order down the chain of command for reasons of preventing misinformation or keeping panic from being created or what have you. But in fact, it's having exactly the opposite effect.
Lori Garrett, I want to thank you very much for being with us. I know you too aren't feeling well, and thank you for your reporting. Lori Garrett of Newsday here on the War and Peace Report, Democracy Now! In Exile. When we return, we're going to look at the issue of the expansion of police and surveillance powers. And we're going to also talk about undocumented workers and what this tragedy has meant for them and their families. Stay with us.
Keep on moving forward. Keep on moving forward. Keep on moving forward. Never turning back. Never turning back. Gonna keep on moving proudly. Keep on moving proudly. Keep on moving proudly. Never turning back. Never turning back. Gonna keep on singing loudly. Keep on singing loudly. Keep on singing loudly. Never turning back. Never turning back.
Pat Humphreys and friends, we'll call them the Ad Hoc Firehouse Chorus, here on Democracy Now! In Exile's War and Peace Report, live from our Garrett studios. I'm Amy Goodman. By a vote of 36-0, the House Judiciary Committee approved the Bush administration's anti-terrorism bill last night, giving law enforcement officials broad new surveillance powers. House Republican leaders expect the bill to be voted on by the full House next week, 1 month after the attacks on the World Trade Center and Pentagon. The Senate version of the bill is still locked in negotiations. The bill approved by the House would expand the powers of law enforcement officials to wiretap telephones, monitor email traffic, and detain foreign nationals in the course of investigating alleged criminal activity. The proposed anti-terrorism legislation has sparked widespread concern among a broad array of civil rights, civil liberties, and policy organizations across the political spectrum. We're joined now by Mark Rotenberg of EPIC, the Electronic Privacy Information Center. He's executive director. And J. Bradley Jansen, deputy director of the Conservative Center for Technology Policy at the Free Congress Foundation. We welcome you both to the War and Peace Report.
Good morning, Amy.
Good morning.
It's good to have you with us. Let's begin with the Free Congress Foundation, J. Bradley Jansen. Why does your group oppose key parts of this legislation?
Well, the Free Congress Foundation has a project called the Coalition for Constitutional Liberties, and we have a long-standing interest in the broad surveillance programs and defending of our civil rights and constitutional liberties. And we've worked on many of these issues for a long time, opposing Echelon, Know Your Customer, and these other provisions that we're seeing resurrected now.
And when you say Echelon, explain.
It's a network of foreign intelligence agencies of the U.S., United Kingdom, and others. We and others suspect in kind of an oversimplified form that they use this network of intelligence agencies to get around prohibitions on what the National Security Agency of the U.S. is allowed to do. So if we prohibit the NSA from spying on Americans and we have Fourth Amendment constitutional protections here, if the Brits spy on Americans and then just share it with the intelligence community here, they can get around that impediment.
Mark Rotenberg, what are your main concerns?
Well, there are a number of areas where the Attorney General was seeking to very aggressively expand the government's ability to conduct electronic surveillance on American citizens. And our primary concern is that much of the original bill was not focused on the narrow problem of investigating and preventing terrorist acts, but rather a wish list, if you will, for how to increase the powers of federal law enforcement agencies. Now, I think some progress has been made over the last couple of weeks. And at least some credit, I think, should go to the members of the House Judiciary Committee who are now recommending a significantly narrowed bill. There are still problems there that I think groups on both the left and the right would like to see fixed. But I think it's important to understand that the bill that's now before the House is not nearly as broad as where this process started.
Well, can you talk about how wiretapping would be expanded, how email surveillance would be monitored, even in this compromise bill?
Right. Well, under the compromise bill, for example, it will be possible to use a reduced standard to get access to certain types of Internet communications. We have in this country an elaborate procedure that seeks to safeguard the privacy of routine telephone communications. It's not easy, generally speaking, for law enforcement to get legal authority to wiretap a telephone call. But to get access to the records of the numbers that are called by the target in an investigation is much easier to do. And when we talk about new communications technologies like the Internet, for example, I think the view of most groups is that it's important to keep that high standard that we associate with telephone conversation and not drop down to this lower standard for telephone numbers. Unfortunately, the bill that comes out of the House still in some places takes this lower standard. There are also critical questions about the role of the judiciary, because for law enforcement to be overseen effectively in a constitutional democracy, you have to have an independent judiciary that basically gets to check the authority of the prosecuting agency. And we see in a couple of areas the judiciary's role will be diminished somewhat in electronic surveillance. Now, what they've tried to do in limiting some of these problems is basically to sunset some of these provisions and say that at the end of 2003, some of the changes that were made in response to the Terrorist Act will effectively expire. And it's not a bad thought, but the problem is, you know, that's a very long period of time, more than 2 years now, to give the government this expanded surveillance authority. And so we'd like to see that sunset provision moved up as well.
Jay Bradley Johnson of the Free Congress Foundation, can you explain the change of having to, in the past, a judge could approve the wiretapping of one phone, but now it's about wiretapping a person so that you can follow them from landline to cell phone to email, and they get much broader powers there.
Well, traditionally there used to be, you know, more restraints on wiretaps, but they've already got the authority to do roving wiretaps, and this is just a further progression of that. As Mark is right, a lot of groups have come together on both the left and the right to share some of these concerns. All of us want law enforcement to get all of the information they need to bring the perpetrators of the tragedies of September 11th to justice. Where Mark is right is we're all emphasizing the point it's a question of process and due process and how law enforcement is getting the information that they need. The roving wiretaps and the multi-point authority that they're getting in the bill, again, may make some sense in terms of getting the information that they need. The real question is what standards they're going to have to follow to get those wiretaps in the first place.
What about the issue of the CIA now getting involved in domestic surveillance? In the past, it's been prohibited from spying domestically. That was in the purview of the FBI.
Right. That's a very big issue. I mean, there's also important issues related to detention and our immigration policy and how we're going to treat students from foreign countries in this country. I listened yesterday to the markup. I mean, it was an extraordinary survey of a whole range of important civil rights and civil liberties issues. But the question you raised, Amy, which is about giving the CIA the authority to begin to conduct forms of domestic surveillance, I think is a real troubling development for lots of reasons. Not only the history there, which is, of course, a significant problem, but also the fact that one of the things that we try to do in U.S. law, not always successfully, but we try to keep a fairly high wall between law enforcement activities and intelligence gathering activities. And the reason for doing this is there are a lot of things that happen on the intelligence side outside of this country that, for better or worse, would not be permissible in terms of gathering evidence for a criminal investigation. And the evidence that's used in a criminal investigation has to be evidence that courts will accept and that will survive constitutional challenge. Once you remove those procedural safeguards that are intended to make the judicial process work, you really weaken at the structure, at the foundation of our judicial system, how information is collected and used in law enforcement proceedings. And I think, even for people who we probably disagree with most of the time in the law enforcement community, if they really think about this, there are very serious issues here in terms of making law enforcement work once they start commingling information that's obtained from intelligence agencies.
In terms of other countries, have you both been communicating with civil libertarians in other places, since it seems in many different countries this kind of crackdown is taking place?
Well, I'll just jump in here and say that I was actually in Paris last week speaking at a privacy conference to a number of European officials and officials in the French government and urging them in Europe, as we have urged officials in the U.S., to proceed thoughtfully on these new challenges, to not react without some careful consideration of what new law enforcement proposals, new intelligence proposals may have on the rights of citizens. I think there is clearly a sense of threat and need to act, but it's extraordinarily important at this point in time for people to act calmly and deliberately, which is why we've put together this big website, which Free Congress and others have helped make possible. It's called the In Defense of Freedom .org website, which urges people to get behind a statement in support of that goal.
We'd also like to point out that we shouldn't rush to judgment on a lot of things.
Mark Rotenberg. Go ahead.
Okay. We shouldn't rush to judgment on a lot of actions without considering some of the unintended consequences that might actually reduce our national security as well as reduce our privacy. The argument that we have to choose between privacy and our constitutional liberties versus security is a false choice. If we can move away from this mass surveillance of everyone all of the time and redirect our intelligence resources, we spend $30 billion a year on intelligence, towards human intelligence, learn the languages, learn the cultures, and try to infiltrate the groups that are a threat to this country, we can have both more privacy and more security. I've been to Europe a couple of times and in the Caribbean this year, working with other organizations and other groups, trying to undo some of the unintended consequences that are actually reducing our national security. The Financial Action Task Force in Paris has been pushing these bank monitoring program called Know Your Customer that's effectively kind of shut down new business in the Caribbean on their financial side, and it's left these countries open to serious economic problems. In response to that, they've turned to Libya for development assistance. Since the tragedies, their tourism industries have been hurt even more, and they're going to be looking for aid and acceptance, including from terrorist states. The end result is that we actually reduce our national security without really getting much benefit that they were trying to get on the law enforcement side.
How do you think people in this country should be involved with this legislation right now?
Well, I think they should go to the website, indefenseoffreedom.org, one long word and no punctuation, read the statement that's there, add their name and support, the websites of the organizations that are participating, including Free Congress and epic.org. We yesterday posted on our website the links for the audio cast of the House Judiciary Committee hearing, which, as I said, I thought was an extraordinary hearing, one of the most interesting discussions I've heard in many years in Washington, and urge the representatives to be very careful at this time of crisis, not to sweep broadly into fundamental rights and fundamental liberties in this country. I think those mistakes, if they're made, will be with us for a very long time. I'm going to have to run, though, Amy, and I just wanted to thank you for the opportunity to be on the program this morning.
I want to thank you very much for both being with us. We've been speaking with two experts on the issue of privacy, Mark Rotenberg, Executive Director of EPIC, the Electronic Privacy Information Center, and J. Bradley Janssen, Deputy Director of the Center for Technology Policy at the Free Congress Foundation. And we're going to move to another issue right now before we're joined live in our studio by people in New York who have been dealing with undocumented immigrants in New York, deeply affected by the attacks on the World Trade Center. But before we are joined by these guests in our studio, five protesters arrested during the Republican convention last fall in Philadelphia for blocking intersections and highways as part of a street theater performance were acquitted this week in a Philadelphia court. The activists are involved in the movement to close down the U.S. Army School of the Americas at Fort Benning, Georgia, which trains Latin American military officers and has a long history in graduating some of the world's worst human rights abusers. They say that if the Bush administration is serious about fighting terrorists and cutting off their funds, it might begin right here at home. Allison Stein is with us from School of the Americas Watch. Can you talk about the action that you were in Philadelphia that you were arrested for?
Sure. The action that I was a part of was a street theater action, which was intended to kind of raise an awareness about what goes on at the School of the Americas and what people who have received this training go on to take part in. So there were two of us dressed as graduates of the School of the Americas, and four others dressed as peasants from Latin America who were later massacred using red paint and were lying on the sidewalk. And due to kind of lack of visibility and lack of attention, we then proceeded to move the bodies into the street and conduct our street theater out there, at which point we were arrested.
And can you talk about the trial?
The trial was definitely a surprise. It was quite an experience. I think a lot of us were pretty nervous because of this new war on terrorism and the knowledge that activist groups within the United States, I'm thinking specifically of the Plowshares movement, have already been deemed terrorist groups. And having that knowledge, we were a little worried that our civil liberties would be kind of stepped on again in the courtroom as they have been in the past. But fortunately, I think we were really able to reach the judge with our message, thanks to Bishop Tom Gumbleton and others who were able to speak about the School of the Americas and the issue and to just really raise an awareness in the courtroom and to the judge about how strongly we feel about this issue and how we really felt a need to speak out on behalf of the people that are dying every day as a result of the training at the SOA. So I really feel like we got something through and that justice, for once in one of these trials, was actually done in a courtroom, and I'm very pleased about that.
There's a growing attempt, it seems, by U.S. officials to link U.S. globalization activists with terrorism. I mean, the targets of the attacks, World Trade Center, you know, finance capital of the world, and a Pentagon being military, also the targets of nonviolent protesters. What is your reaction to that?
I think that the attacks of September 11 are definitely an excuse to really draw the anti-globalization movement into this ring of terrorists. I've already heard stories of people connected with the Sandinista movement of the 80s, activists in the Plowshares movement, activists in the anti-globalization movement being put on lists of people involved in terrorist activities, people having increased surveillance brought against them. It's definitely a concern, and at this point, I think that it's more important than ever for activists involved in social justice to really exert our civil liberties by not being afraid and by continuing to speak out and take to the streets and get our message out there so that this can't be used against us and so that we can show that we are a presence that is a nonviolence presence that is not going to go away regardless of what happens, because we are training terrorists in this country, and it's more important now than ever to get that out there.
Well, I want to thank you very much for being with us. Allison Stein, how old are you?
I'm 18 years old.
You're 18. So what got you involved with us?
I first got involved when I traveled to Nicaragua when I was 16 and was able to witness some of the effects of World Bank IMF policies on the people of Nicaragua, and then also traveled to Chiapas, Mexico, where I was able to spend some time living in homes of people who are under daily threat of military violence, many of these people having received training from the School of the Americas. These people are targeted because of their political beliefs, because they're speaking out against economic globalization, because they're speaking out against NAFTA. And so I was really able to get to know them, to get to know their children, and to witness their struggles. And that was what really led me to get involved with the movement to close the SOA. It was having seen the human face of the training that goes on.
Well, Allison Stein, I want to thank you for being with us. If people want to get in touch with School of the Americas Watch, where can they call or go on the web?
The phone number here is 202-234-3440, the SOA Watch website, soaw.org. And also to view pictures of the action, people can go to soawne.org.
Thanks again. You are listening to the War and Peace Report. We'll be back in a minute. John Mellencamp, Peaceful World. You're listening to Democracy Now in Exile's War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. No company will report them missing. Family members may be afraid to tape their photographs on buildings and subways or in hospital entrances in the desperate hope that someone will find them. They'll likely not be counted in the final tally of those killed in the September 11th attacks on the World Trade Center. They're the undocumented immigrants who worked as vendors, delivery people, cleaners, and other low-wage jobs. Their families and friends are too afraid of immigration officials to come forward. Very few families of victims have received any of the millions of dollars of donations raised to help those affected by the tragedy. Livelihoods have also been lost. The Asociación Tepeyac de New York has tallied some 700 mostly undocumented people left jobless because their jobs are behind Ground Zero barricades downtown. Most undocumented workers here were the sole support of an entire family back home. We're joined now by three people who have been dealing with this over the last few weeks. Yoel Magallon is executive director of Tepeyac here in New York. Arnulfo Chino is one of the survivors of the World Trade Center attack. And Monami Malek is a community organizer with DRUM, DESE's Rising Up and Moving, which works with the South Asian community here in New York. Arnulfo Chino, what happened on September 11th? Where were you?
Well, I was on a two blocks away from the disaster. When I arrived over there, it was like 9 o'clock, and both towers were on fire already. And then I say, well, automatically, you know, I was thinking, I cannot go to my work because I go through the World Trade Center Plaza. And so I stay right the police start, you know, stop the people to get into the plaza. So then I try to go around to see if maybe I can reach my work, but I can't. So, but I never imagined, you know, these towers, they're going to be down. They're going to be in collapse. And that was, I never imagined that's going to happen. So then I buy a camera, and then I start to take pictures around, both towers was on fire. I was very afraid when I saw people, jumping out of the towers. So that was my big impression over there. And then I go out all the way down through Water Street and Liberty, which is the street that hits the World Trade Center. And I saw parts of the body on top of the cars when the second plane crashed on the tower. And I took pictures also from the body parts of the explosion. And like 5 minutes later, around when the towers went and collapsed, I was like three blocks away. And by the moment, you know, the towers wasn't collapsed, I was running away like crazy. That was, believe me, I say, well, the tower is going to be, it's going to be on top of me. I'm going to die. And then I run in like a couple seconds, and I saved my life because I down about one of the buildings, which is make a bridge over there. So we saved my life for a couple seconds. But as soon as I get in, the dust and the smoke, they cover all of us. There was a lot of people around. And you can hear the yells and the screams, help, help, please, help me. But nobody can do anything because you cannot see anything. So and then a couple seconds ago, then we saw a door open with the light on it. So then we get in. It was a room. So when I get in, I was so lucky. And I said, well, I've survived of the parts of the World Trade Center Tower. So, but I know I'm going to die because I cannot breathe. I cannot see anything. And then, like, 5 minutes later, we released. I was exit right through the building. So then we break a glass, and then we jump in right away. But the moment we're there, it was like 5 minutes. Believe me, I'm going to die. So then I start praying. I say, God, so thanks for everything. And please take care of my family, take care of my kids. And that's it. I was waiting to die because you cannot breathe. It was horrible. So as soon as I get off from there, after we break the glass, so we're running away from the towers. So we see a cop. He told us, don't run to that way. Go the other directions. So then we change the direction, and we running all the way down to Wall Street and FDR Drive. So when I was there, I said, well, thank God I'm alive. But believe me, it was like a couple minutes, I mean 5-7 minutes, I feel that I'm going to die.
Well, Joel Magallon, Executive Director of Tepeyac, how many people do you estimate didn't make it that we're not hearing about?
We are not sure about how many people are dead now, but we know that there are hundreds of undocumented immigrants who are missing people now, but I think they are dead now. And the problem with this situation with the undocumented immigrants is that all of them are undocumented, all of them are out of the payroll, all of them were working there but without any benefits, and now we know that they were invisible, and they are invisible now, and they are going to be invisible forever. And employers are not going to say anything because they are afraid to receive sanctions because they were hiding undocumented immigrants since many years ago. I think Chino was working there for 10 years, and he never got the permanent residency because his boss didn't want to sponsor him to get the permanent residency. And he's one of the example of people who were working there. We know that there were many delivery boys who were working at the area, not only at the World Trade Center, but also around the World Trade Center. And they could get into the Twin Towers every day, many times a day, going up and down, bringing flowers, newspapers, food, and different things that people who were working there were asking from them. And we know that there are many people who were also workers of the cleaning companies, and the companies are not saying that they were hiring undocumented immigrants. We know that nobody is going to report them because they have they are scared, they are afraid to say that they were hiring undocumented immigrants. They don't want to lose money. And we know that many undocumented immigrants were living in New York City alone, and their families are in many countries in Latin America or Africa or different countries in the world. And we hope that we are asking the government to give them the permanent residency for those workers who are now unemployed. You know, that those people who are residents or citizens, they can go to the unemployment office and they can get 60% of their salary, and so they can survive with 60% of their salary. But these workers who are undocumented immigrants, they are not receiving anything. So we know that even the Red Cross, they are now in our office checking if they can support some of the workers who can prove that they were working there. So who can prove that if they were also working without any ID, they are not in any list, they are not in the checks, so they don't have any way to prove that they were working over there.
Have any people who've come forward been turned away?
I think people who are missing people now. People, families who lost somebody, they are trying to get some help, and we know that they are going to receive some help from the Crimes Victims Fund. But this will be only if they can prove that they were working over there. So we have to wait until the DNA test can match with the DNA test that they have after all the when they move all the stuff from the World Trade Center, and they can put all the samples there. And so how long they have to wait?
We're also joined by Mon Ami Malek of Desi's Rising Up and Moving Drum. Desi's, what does that refer to?
Desis is a common term that refers to people of South Asian origin, so people from the countries of Bangladesh, Pakistan, India, Bhutan, Nepal, Sri Lanka, Guyana, Trinidad.
Mm-hmm. And in terms of undocumented immigrants from this area, how many people do you expect? What are the issues that you're facing in helping people?
I agree with the brother Joel that already the community of South Asians in New York City is such an invisible, and like other undocumented communities of workers and other folks, and this has just made that invisibility even more. Like, our community is very, very devastated right now. One is the folks who are missing, who are actually working inside the World Trade Centers. The estimates are between 600 and 700 people of South Asian origin. And I think it's safe to say that many, many of those people were undocumented workers. A lot of Bangladeshi workers, service workers, were in those buildings. And so we're just trying to find out now exactly how many. And a lot of these folks were also here, single men whose families are back home. So they don't really have roots here. So it's really hard to find out whether they're missing or not. But on top of that, another huge issue that we've had to deal with in the community is the fact of the racist backlash. And so it's not only the folks who are missing in the World Trade Centers, but it's also the fact that a lot of service workers who are South Asian in the city, who are undocumented, taxi drivers, vendors, restaurant workers, have lost their incomes since the attacks, because a lot of folks are not going back to work. For the first week, taxi drivers weren't going to work for fear of attack, because a lot of folks were being attacked. So it's, and a lot of those industries are also devastated, and the people who are being completely affected are the low-wage workers and the undocumented workers.
So what are you doing? How are people helping?
Different groups within the South Asian community are trying to work with organizations that are identifying families first of victims. And we're also trying to do the same thing that Asociación Tepayac is doing, which is really appealing for some of the aid to go to undocumented workers. And another issue is even the Crime Victims Board aid. A lot of people are not going to go there because now there's free flow of information between the NYPD and the INS. So people are not going to go to these sources and, you know, in fear of deportation.
Joel Magellan, how about that issue of the INS working with the police and also the changing laws that are making it easier now?
I think it's very difficult to get some help for the people who cannot prove that they were working over there. So we are sending letters to the senators and congressmen requesting the permanent residency for those workers who were working at the World Trade Center or around the World Trade Center. We are also requesting the citizenship for those workers who died, because this is the only way for their families that they can be legalized as permanent residents and residents, and they can receive some of the benefits that the city or the state of New York, the United States, can give for those people who lost somebody there. Mm-hmm. And we hope also that we can change the situation and get something from workers' compensation for those workers who were at the World Trade Center or around the World Trade Center. So this is difficult because this has to be done for many organizations, many churches, unions, that they have to push this proposal at the Congress. And then we can provide people who can be the witnesses that they are suffering a lot because they are undocumented immigrants. And this is just evidence that this situation is happening in the whole United States for 9 million of undocumented immigrants who were trying to get their permanent residency since many years ago.
How can people help if they want to help with money or give some kind of support? Do you have a phone number people can call?
Okay, we have our website is www.tepeyac.org.
And we'll put that on our website as well. You'll see it at webactive.com. That does it for the program. I want to thank you all very much for being with us.
Thank you for your help.
Democracy Now in Exile is produced by Chris Abrams, Brad Simpson, and Miranda Kennedy. Anthony Sloan, our technical director, Errol Maitland at WBIX.org. You can also hear us at webactive.com. Special thanks to our video team, Chase Pearson, Tony Riddle, Rick Youngers, Karen Renucci, Dee Dee Halleck, Lizzie Ratner, Emily Kunstler, Rachel Jones, Orlando Richards, Tom Poole. And special thanks to Free Speech TV 9415 on Dish TV Satellite. We are just blocks from Ground Zero, from where the World Trade Center towers once stood, in exile from the embattled studios of WBAI, from the studios of The Band and the Fire, from the studios of our listeners. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for listening.
We can work for peace. We will work for peace. We will work for peace. We will work for peace. We can live in 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 peace. Jerusalem, Ramallah. In Washington, in Hebron, in Carmel.